the magnetic pole. I propose to do something fairly similar. I've got a pair of towers on my property, and I have proposed to put a cable between the two towers at the upper level to create a sort of a Faraday shield. Each tower is very well grounded, and by a cable going across the top, essentially going over my house, will give my house some further protection. Now, do I really need it? Probably not, because of the one incident I've had of lightning damage. It wasn't because my tower was struck, because the 110-volt line down the street was struck, and that surge came into the house. Fascinating. I haven't read about that one yet. There was an extremely good program on Channel 21, 10 o'clock last Wednesday night, and if it's repeated, I've been looking at the TV guide, hoping it would be repeated, and it hasn't. I don't see an announcement for the repeat, but the program is called From Here to Infinity. From Here to Infinity. Very well done program, I think by the Brits, but being reproduced by the public broadcasting system. And it's a one-hour show giving you the story of how two independent groups of what would you call them now? Astronomers? Yes, astronomers are the thing you can call them. People with good-sized optical telescopes making very precise measurements as to how fast the universe is expanding and how fast that expansion is slowing down because of the gravity. And as you probably already know, the end of the story is that the first guy didn't believe it. He found out that the outer portions of our galaxy are not slowing down, just speeding up. And the second group came up with the same conclusion. Each group, I think, in the beginning was afraid to announce it because it seemed so crazy. So if two independent studies using two different techniques come up with the same answer, same rate of speed up, most likely is there. And so they've eventually named that dark energy. Doesn't mean they understand it, but they gave it a label, dark energy, as if there was some kind of repulsive force. I personally believe it's not a repulsive force. From my point of view, mankind has been humbled many times in a row. Back in the times when we believed it's the Ptolemaic system, we thought the Earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around it. And along comes Copernicus, who says, no, the sun is the center of our solar system. And pretty soon we found out the sun is not the center of the universe. The sun is just a minor player in our particular island universe, as it used to be called. We now call it galaxy. And then we wanted to believe that our galaxy is the center of the universe. Well, we're a member of a galactic group of a number of galaxies that are bunched together. To a member of that group, and we thought that was the universe. Well, that isn't the universe. That's just a local galactic group, and there's a 10 to the 10 more galaxies out there. That's before you start doing the Hubble Deep Field and Ultra Deep Field photograph of space, and you find out there's a whole lot more galaxies you've never even seen before. So we're not in the center of everything. We've been humble, let's see now. Earth to Sun, that's one. Sun to universe. Really, local galaxy, that's two. Local galactic group is three. Local galactic group to the total universe is four. I think we're about to be humbled the fifth time. We think the Big Bang is all there is. And there's starting to be talk now about not the universe, but multiverses. In other words, we have a local Big Bang that took place 13.2 or 13.5 billion years ago. But I guarantee you, there's more out there. There's other Big Bangs. So I think the stuff out at the perimeter of our Big Bang, our universe, the one that we observe, our observable universe, I think that stuff is being sucked over the hill into the next adjacent universe, so to speak. And so I don't think there's repulsion going on. I think it's a simple retraction out of the perimeter. That's my belief. Each time I go to an astronomy meeting and I mention that, like at Stony Brook or whatever, they say, no, that can't be it. Well, let's wait and see. That's a pure guess on my part. It's not based on anything yet. Traceable to the Bureau, if you know what I mean. So if you do see this program, From Here to Infinity, and if you have the slightest interest in astronomy, optical astronomy, state-of-the-art equipment, state-of-the-art measurements, and how this guy had great trouble getting telescope time to make this measurement. When he finally got the telescope time and made the measurement, everybody wanted to join on that bandwagon and make similar measurements. All the major optical telescopes around the world jumped on the bandwagon. Some of the really good measurements were done by that group, the European Southern Observatory, in the Paranal Plain down in Chile. This is at a very high mountain location, which is extremely dry that I talked about before. So when you see that program, set aside some time and watch it. It's a goodie, in my opinion. Okay, do we have any questions on what Paul has told us so far? And I guess next week we'll give us some more words about how Spirit and Opportunity are doing. They are 3 and a fraction years into a life that was only close to the last 3 months. So we've had our money's worth out of Spirit and Opportunity. These two remotely controlled cars that are driving around 2 different sections of Mars and making all kinds of measurements. And I guess the Spirit now is going into this very deep valley to make some measurements. And there's good reason to believe that Spirit will never get back out of that valley. But the Spirit and the operators are willing to make that dedication because the data they're going to get they think is valuable enough that if they lose the spacecraft and can't get it back out of the hole, particularly because one of the wheels is not working very well and they got to keep dragging it, they think it's a good investment because that particular valley they're going into, this crater, is so big that it goes down to what looks like the bedrock of Mars. And when they start investigating that bedrock, they're going to find out something about the very early history of Mars. I'm going to go over to, I'll give a little bit of a delay and see if anyone has any further questions they want to ask about what they've heard or a new question that they want to put on the net. And if not, we're going to go over to Mel, and he's going to go to his mailbag. Anybody got any want to check in right now? Give me your call letters and name, please. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2MB. I'm just listening. A little tired tonight, but I just want to know I've been listening. And good evening.
And Dick, one other comment.
Okay, Paul recognized. I'm going to turn it over to you in a minute, Paul. Barry, I was thinking about you today. I was up on the roof of my house, removing all the jazz and all the leaves and clutter that was in my gutters to make sure they all flow easily because I knew some terrible weather was coming. I'm looking up at my tower and I say, gee, I hope that's going to give me lots of protection because I'm hearing thunder in the background. I knew that some pretty wicked weather was coming toward us. You and I both get the protection from our towers. And in theory, our houses never get directly struck, even though the power line down the street gets struck. What else was I going to say about lightning? Okay, over to you, Paul. WS2M, T2RIW.
Okay, I know I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, but this STS-118 Endeavour mission, Barbara Morgan, will be on board at the set of the Teacher in Space program. They're called the Educator Astronaut. We went through that a couple of weeks ago. But any young people should be interested in that. And I'll be looking for her report when she comes back, going up to the International Space Station. That's a big difference than what Krista McAuliffe wanted to do, the first teacher in space. Unfortunately, that Challenger blew up. You know, they weren't going to the International Space Station, but they have a place to go. She'll be able to report on it. And I think that should be very interesting. And, okay, I wrote down from here to Infinity, I think you wrote, or you were said, Dick. I wrote that down. I'll look that up. And I wasn't on last week, but wanted to, I know you let everybody know about the space elevator that was shown on PBS. And I was thinking, maybe maybe it wasn't going to be a repeat. I don't know if you saw it, but it turned out it was a repeat there. But good show anyway. All about the space elevator. Back to you, Dick WS.
Yeah, Mel and I got a lot of mail on that particular subject, the space elevator, that really excites people. I didn't know it was going to be a repeat. A little bit disappointed, but still, it's worth seeing again. And that's a really fantastic idea. I hope we do get a chance to carry that one out. It's going to take the price of putting stuff into space and divide it by 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, some very big number. And a lot of stuff's going to be hauled into space by that technique. So we're going to carry out any of the things that's advocated by, why can't I think of the man, who, the science fiction writer who thought about the space repeater, satellites, and whatever. Why can't I think
of Arthur C. Clarke.
That's the guy, Arthur C. Clarke. If you're going to carry out any of his great ideas, we really need a space elevator, who I think he also mentioned it. I believe he's one of the inventors of that thing, too, with some of his early science fiction. Guy's a real good forward thinker. Wonder what we've gotten in the mailbag this week, Mel, and what's the latest there in Manhattan Beach, keeping all those guys busy and pushing the state of the art. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening again. This is Now you're talking about the towers that they're going to put down in Florida. Not just going to install those towers. Years ago, there were towers I wanted to have to explore. They were called the San Diego Towers. They were put up, I guess, around World War II. I think they were the Navy Department of communication across the Pacific, which eventually, they stood all the years, and they finally, they said no more use of them, and they blew them up. If I remember correctly, there's a whole bunch of dipoles connected between them. I'm wondering if you are familiar with them, Dick, over.
No, I'm not. However, there was a radio site in Fayetteville, Long Island, a very large radio site in the mid-1915 time period, right around the beginning of World War I, where spark gap transmitters and ARC transmitters were being used for communicating information across the Atlantic Ocean. And there's a website I can send you to that will show you some beautiful pictures, W2KRM. George Flanagan is a bit of a radio historian, and he's collected all of the pictures of that particular site. And they had, I think, 450-foot-high radio towers with the antenna structure, and they were running numbers like 100,000 watts of spark transmitter power. Wow. And the local equivalent of Long Island Lighting Company was supplying that power, although they had to give them forewarning when they're putting the transmitter on the air, so they could be adjusting, because that's one hell of a load. Something else about lightning I was going to mention. Gee, keep forgetting it. But lightning's pretty wicked stuff. And if your radio tower is not well grounded, it could give you quite a bit of grief as far as your transmitters are concerned. So the San Diego towers, I wonder how tall they were, how many they were, and was that way back in the days of spark and arc transmitters. And there is a difference between spark and arc, believe it or not. Back to you, Mel. H-U-K-U-Y, H-U-R-I-W.
Yeah, this is K-U-K-U-Y. I believe they were 600-foot tall self-supporting towers when I looked at them many years ago. And they were put up, I think, either in the late 30s or maybe just, yeah, I guess just before World War II, if I'm not mistaken. Used extensively during the Second World War. Of communications, I can say, across the Pacific. And a couple of years ago, they decided, the Navy Department decided that they had no more use of taking up a lot of land, and they blasted the legs out, down, things come crashing down, and chopped them up for scrap. And they were big, tall towers, Dick. I remember looking at those things. And like I say, they were 600-foot tall towers. Can you imagine them coming down when they blasted them, Dick, over?
I sure can. The tallest self-standing structure that I know of, I think, is the CNN Tower, as it's called. Is that in Canada? I think it is. I think it's like 1,800 feet. And it's got a restaurant on the top of it. I've got a book on tall structures. And that's the tallest self-standing structure. The tallest standing structure that with guy wires is the radio station tower in Grand Forks, South Dakota. It's Grand Forks area. There is a 2,050-foot tower, which now is the tallest structure on Earth. It used to be the tallest structure was the Radio 1 tower in Plock, Poland. 2,150 feet, roughly, which was felled because the low bidder got the contract to replace the guy wires that were rusting, and he didn't do it correctly and collapsed the whole tower. There's an art and science to replacing guy wires on a tower. Barry and I have done things like that. Barry's tower doesn't need guy wires, but mine does. And I've replaced guy wires on towers now, I guess on two occasions. Survived the episode, and you really have to put a new guy wire on before you remove the old one. And as I've said many times, people misunderstand the physics of all this. The lower guy wires are the ones that can get you in the most trouble if they're not there. As you know, the station is now WGBB in the Amityville area of Long Island, or in the Islip area. In roughly 1969, I think it was, some of the children teenage kids at around midnight went and started cutting those guy wires with a hacksaw. And they cut the lower guy wires first, collapsed the whole tower, and one of those teenagers died because it fell on him as it collapsed. So guy wires are very important on towers. To make a tower more than 330 foot tall, the SSD Yonaco Rhone towers that were quite popular, you go to Sunnyside Boulevard, which is near exit 49, I think it is, on the Rhone Expressway, and you look north, you'll see a pair of 330 foot towers, Rhone SSD type, and 330 feet is about the tallest that is popular commercial. There are special structures that are going beyond that that don't require guy wires. Eiffel Tower is certainly a very good example. Very close to 1,000 feet before you add the television broadcasting antenna on top of the Eiffel Tower. I think Eiffel Tower is something like 980 feet, 990. And considering that that steel structure with nowhere near the quality of modern steel was built something like the 1890 time frame, that Mr. Eiffel really was one hell of a structural engineer, civil engineer, to design such a structure, which was put up for the World's Fair as a temporary structure. And enough people fell in love with it to say, let's keep it 600 foot. And I guess you're saying the San Diego towers, were the three of them melt? K2KEY, K2LAW?
Here we go.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, got a comment. Pick up Mel first. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, you got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. No, those two towers in San Diego. Two of them were that was sitting so that the antennas, dipoles were actually parallel to the Pacific Ocean. And they were self-supporting, no guy wires, just big steel structure. The tallest right now, the tallest structure man-made right now, Dick, is in Dubai, in the Middle East, or the Gulf, there. They just finished building a condominium over there. I guess it's a condominium that went up over 2,000 something feet. And they said, well, they look at it this way, that the tallest structure for thousands of years man-made was the pyramid in the Middle East there. They said, well, we decided we're going to take the lead again as the tallest structure on the earth man-made. Now with the building that they put up there in Dubai. I saw pictures of it, and it sticks right up there. Boy, it sticks up. You know, they got a lot of skyscrapers they're building there. They're really building like crazy. Of course, they got a lot of big buses coming in from those oil wells. And so they're really building like crazy there, and they're building a lot of skyscrapers. But this one they got is it is a tall one, H.I. And as far as towers go and all, yeah, well, the tower I have here, not a tall tower, it's 85 feet, but like I said, I told you about how I desensitized it. I got that pin on top of the mast up there, that sharp pin. So that's why I desensitized the lightning bolt, thins it out to that point so that in other words, reduces the surface area where the lightning bolt will strike. Let's see. Oh, yes, and I got a question here. First question I got is about what we discussed last week with guy wires. But, all right, pick up Rich first, and then we'll start with what some of the good ones I have here. K2RIW in the text. This is K2KEY.
I just Googled Dubai Tall Tower, and the very first article that came up was written in December 2004, and claims that Dubai is building a tower that's going to be 800 meters tall. I'm a little skeptical of that. That's almost 2,500 feet. That's half a mile. I'll bet you they slacked off a little bit on that. Wow. I'll have to look at some of the later articles. Okay, you're Rich. You got it.
Okay, Dick. Maybe Mel can answer this question concerning towers. when you go down the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, past Brooklyn Navy Yard, want to get a glimpse of it, but there's two towers on top of a tall building in the Navy Yard with some wire, typical 1930-1940 vintage wire antennas strung between them, and some line. I'm wondering if anybody knows what it was, if it's being used, and more importantly, what is it still connected to? Back to that.
Yeah, Don, good question. I don't know. When I went to Pratt Institute, I was not a very long distance away from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. In fact, a number of the students were so-called Navy Yard students being subsidized by the Navy Yard as they attended that particular school. So you're saying there's some pretty tall towers there. How long do you believe those towers have been there? And I think you're not talking about the David system that's used for lifting hardware onto ships that are under construction. You're saying that there were two tall, self-standing radio towers with or without guy wires there, Rich? Go ahead.
Yeah, on a tall building, on the roof of the building. You know, I'm one of these guys that still looks around at roofs being here. And the typical radio towers with a wire antenna, it looks like they got three or four wires strung, not dipoles, typical 1930 construction.
Okay, very nice. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, what he's talking about is actually the same antenna they used to use on the battleship. I know one of the people up there, and it's still got a long wire that comes down into the building, and that used to be where they would, during the war, they would make communications with the ships that were coming in.
What's your guess as to how tall those towers are, if you happen to know, Eric?
They're not that tall. I think they're like 70 or 80 feet. But they have a typical multiple long-wire, multi-tunable type antenna that they would use on the military ship.
Call it, Dick.
Go ahead.
Hey, those two towers, that's what's called the Brooklyn Army Terminal. During World War II, they had a lot of receiving equipment there, and they were using it, yes, for communications with ships, basically it was a listening post. And my father had a friend that was stationed there, and I was up there, and telegraphed under contract during World War II. That's where they delivered their first supplied receiver. Sort of receiver there. Oh boy, what a receiver. Jeez, I always wonder what happened to that receiver. I have a feeling it was thrown in the dumpster. That's an unfortunate part. But they had their diversified receivers in there. What a piece of equipment. And that's where was part of the, that time, the Brooklyn Army Terminal 6. The towers on top of the roof there, they were 100, if I remember correctly, 125, I believe they were, 125 feet tall, Dick, over.
And how, you say they were on the roof, how tall was the structure they were mounted on?
The building was 8 floors, I believe. You know, it's a long time ago. I was there when I was maybe 15. So we're going to put that back. Should I say how long ago, Dick? You know how long ago, I won't say, over.
I know the exact year and the month. But by the way, Eric, I may have mentioned this to you before. When I was in Holland on a bus going from Belgium, I guess it was, into Amsterdam, I remember seeing in the distance this really significant structure. And I sat and watched it for many miles up the front window of the bus. It looked to me, it was a television broadcast station in Holland, and it looked to me like approximately 1,000 feet of tower with guy wires mounted on top of what looked like about a 10-story building, a fairly round building, which I presume was the broadcast center, and then coming out of the top of the building was what looks like 1,000 feet of guide tower. What a significant structure. Wonder if you've ever seen or heard about that one. I may have forgotten some of the details. Over to you, Eric.
No, okay. I'm not really, I've heard of it. I haven't seen pictures of it. I'm not that aware of it. You know that there are a number of towers in this country that are 2,000 feet and a little bit more that are all guides. And we had one of the riggers over not too long ago. He was telling us about the story of the station, I think it was Iowa. I asked one of the states in the Midwest where they had a problem with one of the towers. The tower came down, and there's a tower right next to it, and the folks were not very careful while they were moving the debris and took the other tower down with it, and a few people's lives.
Yeah, that was, there was a website where you could watch the movie of that happening. The first tower became damaged. The repair was declared to be too expensive. It was declared a total loss. So they decided to collapse the first tower, but it was only approximately 100 or 150 feet away from the second tower. Both of them were roughly 1,000-foot high structures, but only 100 or 150 feet apart. As they cut the guy wires on the first tower, the guy wires spun back, spiraled, and spiraled around the guy wires of the second tower. So as the first tower fell, the tugging of the guy wires of the second tower fell the second tower. I guarantee somebody said, R blank. Or, oops, wow, Mother Nature is a little bit cruel at times. You really better study the physics of that. I can think of a million ways that they could have avoided that problem. I found another website about the Dubai Tower, which says presently the title for the world's tallest building is the Taiwan Taipei 101, which is 508 meters tall. The Dubai exact height hasn't been disclosed, but it has been confirmed that it will be over 700 meters. That's 2,200 feet roughly. Wow. And will be completed in 2008. What a structure. Thank goodness they don't get high winds in that area. That was a joke. It does look like it's pretty substantial. It's got a pretty wide base to it. How far can you push it? And are they going to have a good sprinkler system? Can you imagine a fire in an upper story? A hook and ladder is not going to help you in that particular case. And how do you get the thousands of people out of that building if for some reason you do have to do it? Evacuation of a building like that. And the elevator system. You study the articles that have been written about the World Trade Center and its express and local elevator system. I think there was something like 39 elevators in each one of those buildings. What a system. Okay. Let's go over to your mailbag, yeah, Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, Nick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you know that, I think I heard you mention that the WLIX tower in the late 60s is in, I think it was in West Iceland, where the kids cut the guy wire and took themselves with it, or took one of the kids with it, and actually had a chunk of that tower in my, I used that for a tower in the 70s in my backyard. And believe it or not, Elliot, who is the proprietor of the station that we rent, which is chief engineer of that station.
Wow. How about that? A lot of history over there. And very nearby is where the Iceland Speedway was, and for a lot of years the Limock held their flea markets at the Iceland Speedway. Nice big chunk of land that was very convenient as far as the location and size and whatever is concerned. And one of the amateur radio operators, who was also a helicopter pilot, once flew his helicopter into the stadium that was in the middle of the Iceland Speedway Stadium. And quite a story that turned out. Okay, Mel, go right ahead with your mailbag. K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yeah, one more word. The tower in, in Coney Island, the old parachute tower. So, you know, when they redid that thing, that a winch was laying there. So I asked the guy, what are you going to do with that? He said, throw it in the junk pile. Well, that was the winch that pulled the parachutes up. So the winch, they cut these cables that were hanging loose for so many years, just swinging in the wind. You know, when they took the parachutes off of it, they closed the ride down. I just left the guy, you know, that the parachute rolled down on the, he sealed these cables. Basically, were leaving them just floating in the wind. They just were blowing back and forth. So they cut them down, you know, they redid the whole thing, made a monument out of it. So I took, out a piece of that rusty guy wire in the garage. And that's the joke everybody said, well, you're so close to it. You know, so one of my friends, cuties, he took a picture of the, she took him out there, we walked over the parachute jump in the house, took a picture of it, and showed everybody to get home. He said, how do you like this thing? So everybody thinks that's my power, Coney Island.
Your push to talk is giving you some trouble, Mel.
Oh, okay, sorry. That's just this little button on the mic. Am I okay now?
Sounds good now.
Okay. No, for that, I just started to laugh. That power, by the way...
That's a button.
Very close. Nice. Okay. I'm sitting down here and stretching the cord and holding the mic upside down. Oh, that tower is 325 feet tall. I could say it's a monument now. The first question, in fact, is about guy wires that we discussed last week, Dick. You want to continue with this? Over.
One of my favorite subjects, guy wire, and what Mr. Roebling invented when he invented what is now called guy wire, and he invented for the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge way back in what? 1885 or so?
I do. Okay, yeah. The Roebling literally called it wire rope because of the timeless.
That's funny.
Hold on, sorry. The bridges they put up here and there, the rope, you know, they use rope. And I guess it wasn't really the best thing to do, but... the way rope.
It's doing it again.
It is the wire. Wire rope, Dick, over.
Yeah, that button is still giving you some grief, Mel. And that wire rope comes in one strand, seven strands. I think the next case is 17 strands and so on. I've got a few books on the subject. And all kinds of great care should be used with wire rope. The, I can't think of the name of the thing now. Choker. Is what I call it. One of the things that they use when you've got a crane site and you're holding up equipment to a building, it's very convenient to have a chunk of wire rope with a thimble on each end and a hook on each end, and you're supposed to wrap the choker around the equipment that you're hauling up, and you're supposed to bring the hook back up to a shackle-like device that's connected to the crane cable. And never, never are you allowed to connect the hook to the wire itself. You bend the wire sharply back on itself. Wire rope that's bent too sharply will experience permanent damage and weaken. So there's a bend radius for every kind of guy wire and wire rope that you should not exceed. In other words, don't bend it any sharper than that particular number. Devices that I use that go through the turnbuckle called thimbles, we were discussing that last week, and your wire should always be, no sharp edges should be coming against your particular wire. Some guys will wrap the wire around the leg of the tower as a method of guying the tower, and the leg itself has got a nice diameter to it, but the arms of the tower, not the arms, the steps of the tower, the zigzag steps, do represent kind of a sharp point of contact, which could damage the wire, and the wire has swayed back and forth a little bit, and it's going to be scraping against that step, and it's going to eventually give you some more wear and fraying and whatever. So no matter where your guy wire goes, it should always be wrapped around this thimble device, which really looks like a U-channel belt bent back into almost a question mark, and the wire lays into it, and that in turn goes into your turnbuckle or into... around the tower leg, so that the wire itself is always protected. Guy wire proper use. There's an art and science to it, You should read books on the subject. You should read the appropriate section of the Rhone Power Catalog, which describes how to properly install guy wires, how to whip the ends correctly, and so on. All of this is definitely required for safety reasons. Guy wire can definitely make the difference between life and death. You've heard the stories of these hams on Long Island in the Smithtown area about 10 or 15 years ago. They were lowering something like 60 or 70 feet of tower. You had one group of guys disconnecting guy wires on the ground, another group of guys that were disconnecting tower sections and lowering them with a jib pole assembly, and the guy wire disconnecting crew got ahead of the other crew, and pretty soon the tower was standing there with no guy wires, and the guys on the tower became heavily injured when about 40 feet of tower they were on fell over and fought against the ground. So you gotta go slow and think carefully about guy wire. And by the same token, for the guys who will build some kind of a pulley mechanism and slide a very heavy antenna up the guy wires as a method of getting it to the top of the tower, you gotta be careful to calculate the forces that are involved with that operation to make sure you're not overstressing those guy wires. Some guys will put a temporary set of guy wires on the top of a tower. Like, say, for instance, the top 15 feet of the tower is unguided. They'll put one or two temporary guy wires in one particular direction and slide the antenna they want to put up there on those temporary guy wires. Well, they forget about the fact that they're pulling very heavily on the tower in one direction only. The force multiplication you can get in a situation like that is staggering. And so make sure that somebody does those calculations ahead of time before you do it. Otherwise, all kinds of nasty things can happen. So go ahead and let's discuss guy wires. Sorry, I took so long. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Get over to the radio here and not be so late. Where it won't stretch the wire so much. Pull away from me. I let go of the button anytime. I think someday I got to figure out a way of modifying this thing. That's one of the problems. I got the radio. It's very cheap. It's like nothing. So can't make any complaints about it. The guy wires, I know a guy got killed about 2 years ago, taking down a 40-meter beam up on a 125-foot tower. And he was an experienced man. I mean, he was in that business and everything like that. He went up there and he was taking beam broke and was taking for some reason. I don't know what happened, really. And about this big beam, big 40-meter beam, got it down. It just tore the guy wires. It sheared the guy wires all down. The tower collapsed. And that was the end of it. So, like you say, guy wires make or break the job. Fortunately, a lot of people, I guess, don't know what they're doing. They shouldn't be doing it. I always say, if you don't know what to do, say so. What a disaster. Later on, it's too late to go back. Last week we discussed guy wires and chase. And I told what I did, I coded them and everything. And I broke them up and the method, those insulators I used and everything, those brown porcelain insulators that I bought, and put them in to break up the guy wires. And you mentioned that the same time that they're in, I'm confused. Mel says he broke up the guy wires so that it would not in any way hamper the operation of his beam, proper operation of his beam. Dick said that he did not break them up at all, and I'd like to know, when I replace the guy wires, do I go through all the trouble of breaking up the guy wires, or do I put solid guy wires? By the way, this is a 60-foot tower that I have, and I'm going to replace. That's all. That's personal. Replace the guy wires that we talked about last week. So we want to know this. What the necessity of yes or no, I guess that's the question. Over.
Okay, this is an area that's a little bit controversial. Many amateurs have very strong opinions on this one. I have a very strong opinion. Mine is not the last word. Listen to my words, study it, ask people, dig deeper, so to speak, and find out what's really going on. The vast majority of the time, I feel breaking up guy wires is not required. Each of those extra insulators, all the hardware around them, represent more potential locations for possible failure. So the reliability of the tower with a whole bunch of lasers all the way around it lowers the reliability of the tower and runway system, in my opinion. Second of all, common sense would lead you to believe, well, make sure your guy wires are not resonant. You'll soon discover that resonance is a rare phenomenon, and even if you do get resonance, are you really going to get a problem from it? Let me show you what's going on. The worst case example I can think of, the guy who's putting up an 80-meter dipole, let's say 60 feet in the air, the dipole is 135 feet long, 60 feet in the air, right across the street from him, is Con Ed or LIPA power line, also 60 feet in the air. And right across the street from him is the direction of the space guy he wants to talk to, his buddy in London. And he talks to him on 80 feet. Without a doubt, the wires of the loco lighting system between his telephone poles directly the exact same altitude as his antenna looks like an extremely serious blockage in that direction. First of all, the 80-meter dipole, when it is resonated, when I am now the system, the dipole, the transmission line, the antenna tuner, and the final stage of the transmitter, that total system must be resonated to radiate efficiently. Without resonance, you'll have less than 1% of the radiation. With proper resonance, you'll get 99% of the radiation. So you will resonate it. When you do, you go back to the basic formula, gain equals 4 pi A effective of a lambda square. You know that your dipole has 2.14 dB of gain over isotropic. And that formula is for isotropic gain, not decibels, hard number. Solve it for area, and then dipoles have 2.14 dB of gain, and all the wavelength is, solve for area, area gain length square root pi. You will discover that your 80-meter dipole, when resonated, has an effective radio area of 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters, you would see a great big black oval around your antenna. If it's a horizontal antenna, it's a horizontal oval, which is a little bit wider left and right than the whole dipole is. And I'm not sure what the exact dimensions are, 30 or 40 feet vertically is an oval. So any radio signal, horizontally polarized on 8 meters, entering that black oval area, almost all of the energy ends up on the wire, goes down the field line, and if you estimate it, that across the street from LIPA is not resonant. With rare exception, it is not resonant. That wire has a square foot area of a couple of square feet. So the wire is casting a shadow on your antenna. But it's casting a shadow of a few square feet on 8,500 square feet of effective radio area of your dipole. So if you did an experiment with the LIPA wire present and the LIPA wire not present, in case of your dipole, in case of your guy wires on a tower, very few of your antennas are inside the guy wire system. The guy wires usually go up to the 90% altitude of the tower, and most of your really critical antennas, particularly the VHF antennas, are up above that, outside of the guy wire system. Even if your guy wire system was a complete cone of metal, it would just be a wide tower that your antenna is on top of. It's outside of it, no problem. Even if now mount a few of your VHF antennas inside of those guy wires. Yeah. Although the situation is not quite as dramatic as it is with an 80-meter dipole running around a VHF frequency, still the guy wire itself is casting a shadow onto the effective area of your 2-meter Yagi or whatever is inside of the guy wire system. I've done that. Some of my antennas, 2-meter rotating antennas, are inside of my guy wires. And when I transmit in the direction of the guy wire, or not a direction of the guy wire, I can't see any difference in the gain. None of my guy wires have that insulator. Even if at worst, the particular length of your guy wire happened to hit resonance at one of your favorite frequencies, the solution to that would be extremely simple. Simply connect a random length of wire somewhere up on the guy wire. In other words, 10 feet off the ground, 5 feet off the ground, you connect another piece of wire off at right angles, clip it onto your guy wire,
and now an extra capacitive loading device to get your bandage, this stuff, this antenna stuff, will stop it from resonating. And if you really want to be elaborate about this, and you're afraid that even that's going to get resonance again, well, make one or two lengths of wire on that stuff with a relay on them. I'd much rather see you put an auxiliary resonance-killing device on your guy wire, but leave the guy wire itself simple, properly installed, and intact. Don't break it up with egg insulators. Only when you hit resonance can the wire give you a substantial amount of area. Outside of resonance, it's a small fraction of the area. So integrity of the wire, to me, is much more important. The tiny bit of shadow it has, and by the way, even if you put, if your guy wire has no egg insulators, it's casting the shadow and creating a little bit of difference in gain, a fraction of a dB. Even with the egg insulator, it'll cast the exact same shadow. So the only way the guy wire can give you a problem is that it hits resonance, and there's a zillion ways you can kill the resonance without using the egg insulator. That's my opinion. I stand behind it. I've used it a lot of years. For me, it works. There are people who think I'm crazy to have that opinion. So when in doubt, dig a little bit deeper. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2KEY. Well, two experience, no correction. All right, here's one special experience, my experience of the gentleman, in fact, the new QST. Construct a rugged heat to build 12 in Yagi for 17 meters. And here he is, just I put the whole thing together, got it up the tower, and first contact, goes on to say, was with PA3D, you know him, YASA, and gave him a 5-9. He said, my disappointment, however, is my SWR on this new antenna was 3-1. And my transceiver now was only putting out 70 watts. He didn't know what the heck was going on here. So I took the Aggie back down, I looked at it and everything like that, and then, as I realized what the problem was, my wife, who also him, created SYL, Sylvia, for her also, had a 40, 20, and 50 meter dipole hanging off the tower, and a 75 meter dipole also, some distance down, three feet below the top of the tower, hanging there, or at the center of our dipole. I took it all down, and voila, my SWR went to 1.1. So, no dipole, that's it, messing up this new antenna. There he is. I should have known that right away, and I should have guessed that, what was wrong. All right. Now, my friend in Pennsylvania, he had another guy, Chip, not a live, no, right now, he's another one of our Pennsylvania guys. He put up a tower, and also put up guide and everything like that, and he asked me what beam, commercial beam, do I recommend, the three-element tri-band beam, and I know one that's fairly good. I don't think I should mention the name on here, but popular, very popular name, works excellent, and uses every year at field day, our club has the same antenna, and he put that up. And he says, let me tell you, I got some real strange problem. He starts talking and telling me this. He says, I rotate the beam, and he says, I get, stations. He says, I should be getting, to see the stations picking up. And he says, sometimes they're like nulling and everything. And he says, he says, my SWR also changes as I rotate the beam. He says, really? And I says, what else is on the tower and all and everything? Nothing. You just put the tower up, just right on top of the tower and all. And I said, thinking and I'm saying, about the guy wires, anything special there? Are you using any kind of backstage or anything like that? And antennas and all. He says, no, just put the guy wires, the new guy wires up. I said, Jim, the only thing I will recommend is you break up the guy wires, egg insulated. And he says, really? I said, I've heard a number of people, mention that. I've done it. And I didn't see the trouble before because I didn't have the guy wires, on as solid first. So, that's the way I installed the installation because
back in the dojo. When I put that up, I listened to the Elvis so-called, you know, expert maintenance on antennas and all. It's definitely got to be done. Definitely. All right. Definitely. So definitely it is. And he went ahead, Jim, and told me, he said, nope, like night and day. He said, rotate the tower. Yeah. He said, boy, the station's west. I turned that as I turned that beam, sometimes west was on. The 15 meters was really bad. 10 wasn't too bad, but 20, 15 and 20. He says, I had no places, things, and now he says, and also my stuff. Well, I was always varying on, no matter which band, the tri-band it was on. He says, after I broke them up, like you mentioned, randomly broke up the guy wires, he says, and all, bit of a job, he says, and all, but boy, he says, I was so desperate, I would try anything. And he says, well, it was like magic. So those are the two, there's that one, you know, direct experience, plus this one in USC kicked over.
There was somebody who wanted to make a call. Who was that?
Yeah, it's okay. I went up the Mexican one to a band and about Robert who was band to Mount Rumble was about. So I wanted to just say that I know where I'd go. 25 and kind of dipoles and satellite dishes. The rocket could be there using Gold America, lots of broadcast radios for the military. Like in Colorado, you got the time clock. Broadcast over.
Okay, I didn't catch your call letters. I think it's my accent. Want to give that to me slowly, phonetically?
ACDL, where are you? The name is Daniel. We spoke two times, Dave.
Okay, Daniel, ACDLYU. You mean Yankee uniform. And your experience and Mel's experience are, I think, extreme cases. But obviously, maybe I'm on weak ground on this one. If at worst your antenna gave you a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, with most of the modern day antenna tuners, that's not serious. That can be corrected. And a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio is something like 3/4 of the medium loss as long as your transmitter will tolerate it with the antenna tuner and reasonably low low speed line. That goes away. Mel's experience seems to be, Mel's friend's experience seems to be that the antenna pattern is being heavily disturbed and the presence of the guy wire is making the aiming of the antenna a bit spooky. And that's something that can be modeled on a computer program where you figure out exactly what's going to happen. The fact that the guy wires are also radiating, if they hit resonance, may not be bad. Although it's going to make things a little bit more complicated, I think you could live with it. But only if the guy wires hit resonance, in my opinion, could they do that. And if they do hit resonance, stopping them from resonating, there's a lot of ways of doing it. Putting in extra egg insulators, randomly distributed, so to speak, or with a very definite pattern to it, is one approach. I think that's a hard way and slightly less reliable way. I would do it by other ways if I did hit that resonance phenomenon. But with the antenna above and outside of those guy wires, the amount of interaction between the two with reasonable guy arrangement shouldn't be that great. Shouldn't be. There seems to be experience that there is. You've got to be careful now about how you read the experience. Other things could have been going on. In the case of standing wave ratio, lots of people have lots of opinions. I can get on 20 meters in theory any Saturday afternoon and get into a discussion with whether or not standing wave ratio is affected by transmission line length. And the majority of people on that band at that time will say, yay, daily. Whenever I add a random length of cable to my transmission line system, to my antenna, I get a brand new standing wave ratio reading. And there's a lot of reasons why that can happen. And because they saw it with their own eyes, they're positive that VISLAR is line length sensitive. In the pure sense, it is not. But when people see it, they say, aha, it's got to be. And the two or three things that can cause that effect to be seen with your eyes, and you interpret that as the VISLAR being line length sensitive. The line length sensitivity is only there if you happen to have substantial cable, substantial RF energy flowing down the outside of your cable because there wasn't a proper balance feeding structure and balance and whatever at the antenna to transmission line interface. So with
with the signal flowing down the cable. Yes, the cable is now part of your antenna, and the length of that transmission line is going to affect your visual line. But you're really changing the length of the antenna in that case, and it makes some sense. But if your transmission line is really being used as nothing but transmission line, any wave ratio means a certain percentage of your power is being reflected by the antenna, and if the feed line is low enough in laws, how can that make the amount of reflected power go up or down just because you've changed the length of the line? There's a real conflict of physics there if you get down to the basics. So when it comes to guy wires affecting an antenna, without a doubt, it happens at times. If you're unlucky, you hit up one of these resonances. But I'd rather kill the resonance another way. So here's an area where you're hearing multiple opinions. You decide where the truth is, which one you want to pursue. Both techniques will work. Was there any further comments on this before I pass it back to Mel? H-U-L-I-W in the tech net. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I have a question for you, as long as you're on the subject of guy wires. Not to take you away from it, but when you put up your tower, you put up your guy wires, how do you set the tension? How do you know the tension across the guy wires? How much tension do you put on your guy wires? I know how we do it here, although you probably wouldn't like what we do, because we use those dreadful things. It's really not that dreadful when you take plants on it to get in. But I'm just curious how you go about that. And how do you know your tower is straight?
Well, whether or not the tower is straight, there's two different definitions of straight. Is it perpendicular to the ground? Your confidence level will tell you that. If the tower is straight, you sit at the bottom of the tower, you lay on the ground, you look straight up one of the legs. If it's crooked, you'll know real fast. I own a tensiometer. It's made by the Upright Scaffold Company. And what it literally does is that it grabs the guy wire in two places and it applies pressure in the third place, midway between the two. And depending on the amount of deflection, that translates into pounds of tension on the guy wire. Very similar mechanism is used to measure the tension on the fan belts of your automobile. If you go to the NAB handbook, National Association of Broadcasters handbook, under the section of towers, it will tell you a technique that is accurate to the nearest 90%, 10% error. And it consists of knowing how many pounds per foot is your guy wire, knowing how long your guy wire is, you know that ahead of time, you swing the guy wire back and forth to resonate it. In other words, you swing it so that it gets into primary resonance. There's only one wave back and forth on the tower. And you measure how fast it sways, so to speak, and you go to a formula, and it allows you to calculate the tension. That's the poor man's way of doing it. The right way of doing it is with a tensiometer, and once you understand the physics involved, to hone through a tensiometer wouldn't be very difficult. That's the way I do it. Stand by a second. My guess is you guys have a hydraulic device which applies a certain amount of pounds per square inch of fluid to the hydraulic device while it pulls on the guy wire, and therefore it's measuring the tension. Is that the way you did it, Eric? Go ahead.
We use a digital tensiometer. It's a big box. And, this thing leads up to 50 to 60,000 pounds. It's got two huge hooks on it. What we do is we clamp onto the guy wire right where the turn buckles are, and then we basically use the name for it. The hand winch. This is a proper name, but basically what you do is you use the hand winch and the tensiometer and the following big guy wire, 45,000 pounds. And they basically bring it to the absolute value. And then what you do is you start to tighten up on the actual guy mount in the ground. It uses a corkscrew, actually, which is just laced with cement. And what you do is you then use another winch and start to tighten the actual guy wire until you get to the point where the tension on the tensiometer starts to drop.